is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Ukraine crisis, European crisis. I welcome Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He is in the United Kingdom in Lincolnshire, commenting on the two contests immediately before us. One, Ukraine and the battlefield in between Donbass and the Dnieper River Valley. The other, all of European plain facing winter and conditions that require adequate energy without guarantees. We begin with the headlines from Ukraine because it's a mixed picture, but it describes the chaos of battle. For example, Ukraine seizes 400 square kilometers in Kharkiv with opportunistic counteroffensive. This is London reporting, The Telegraph. Also, Germany has, quote, hit the limit for weapons supply to Ukraine. Also, Vladimir Putin insists Russia has lost nothing from Ukraine war. I follow President Putin's remark by reporting that President Putin was out east to the Vostok 22 exercises, part of the annual affair for the Russian military. 50,000 personnel, we're told, 5,000 heavy weapons, joined by parts of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization led by China. So we're looking at large military demonstrations while also at the same time the battles continue in Kyiv. Following the idea that you've got to know where the large players are if you're going to measure the battlefield, I note that while Mr. Putin was out east and looking to meet in Central Eurasia, Mr. Xi, Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, visited Kyiv in what is described by Bloomberg as a new U.S. show of support for Ukraine. In addition to that, we have the reports this morning that the U.S. is now conveying its best artillery pieces, something called the Excalibur, which is very carefully built to hit what it aims at with a GPS within a shell. All of this is a tumble-down way of saying the war continues, following remarks by Kyiv, a commander in Kyiv, that the preparation is for the war to continue into 2023. I mentioned Zaporizhia because we don't have any clarity on it, but the largest nuclear power plant in Europe is now in the battle zone. But not only that, also it is in a condition that is very difficult to project what happens next because it's electricity from the outside, it's power from the outside, that it needs to keep the coolant going in the one reactor that remains online, has now either failed or is not to be relied upon because of the battlefield, and it is or was in a condition known as an island. In other words, it's powering itself, not recommended for a nuclear power plant that can lead to catastrophe for the whole region, not just for Ukraine, for everything in the Black Sea Basin and to the west. Anatole, beg pardon, that's enough bad news. However, the point here is that the war continues in the most chaotic fashion. What is your measure now of Moscow and Brussels? Are they looking to end this conflict or are they looking to prepare for a spring offensive? Good day to you.
Hello, John. Well, Moscow is prepared to go on, it seems. It would be very difficult, I think, for Putin to try to make peace without capturing the whole of the Donbass, even if the West were prepared to offer a peace settlement, which it isn't at this stage. As far as Brussels is concerned, well, which Brussels is the thing? Because you know, if you look at NATO Brussels, it has been obviously, well, throughout, ever since 2008, hard line on turning Ukraine into a Western ally against Russia, NATO headquarters. But the European Union Brussels is deeply divided by now. At least this hasn't fully come out in public, but clearly you have increasing number of voices in Germany, for example, who are saying, look, I mean, we are risking economic disaster as a result of this war. And of course, we're also beginning to point to the fact that Ukraine, well, neither Ukraine nor Russia seem to be making really significant gains on the ground. You know, both claim small gains, but clearly, you know, there hasn't been, at least as yet, any major breakthrough for the Ukrainians. And to show that they have a chance, I mean, at least within the next few months, of inflicting a decisive victory on Russia, they would have to have, you know, to be making much more progress than they are now. My sense is that as we go, you know, into winter, and as you've said, as the energy crisis, the economic crisis deepen, you will have more voices in parts of Europe saying, not necessarily that we need, you know, to move to a peace settlement, because that will be very difficult to achieve, but that we need to move to a ceasefire and the lifting of certain sanctions against Russia in return for a Russian lifting of its ban on energy exports to Europe. But I think it will take, well, we're in September now, will take, shall we say, 2 to 3 months for this sentiment to develop more, or develop to the point where it starts having a real effect in Europe.
Discovering Moscow, we're given information that is not complete. We read in English and we don't have access to the Russian language here. But in speaking with Moscow in these last days, it's colder and it's raining. But the capital seems to continue business as usual. Now, there are reports of the economy trembling, and the projections of the economy are negative, very negative, just as they are in Europe, but even more so. Question here is, Vladimir Putin and his intentions during these last days. We've had a statement from Moscow. Again, it's incomplete information, but it's what we have, of something called Ruski Mir, Russian World, which connects to the most recent tragedy of a car bombing of a young woman who was associated with a thinker who talks about Ruski World. This is generally a description of a thinking, of a philosophy that is based on Russia either pulling up the drawbridges or being extremely guarded about its European neighbors and its Asian neighbors. Is that sustaining? Is that real to your measure? You have the language and you have very good instincts about Russia. Does this describe a general understanding of the population, including all levels, not just the intellectuals in Moscow, that Russia will go on without obvious integration with Europe? Is that a vision?
I'm afraid that it is. I mean, it is, in my view, a very negative vision. But certainly, I mean, it has widespread acceptance in Russian society and in sections of the Russian intelligentsia. And of course, the Western reaction to the Russian invasion of Ukraine has more or less compelled such a vision, given that, I mean, rightly or wrongly, in my view, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly, the West, including Europe, has broken most of the cultural and social bridges to Russia by now. So in a certain sense, I mean, if Russia is not going to basically surrender to Western terms, which Putin has absolutely no intention of doing, this is really the only way that the Putin regime can lead Russia. And indeed, that Russians, you know, who are not going to go into opposition, well, to Russia by now, can go. There is one, for me, deeply sinister aspect to this, which is summed up in the distinction in Russian between the terms Ruski and Rossiyski. Rossiyski basically means the Russian state. It certainly has certain imperial overtones, but it's not an ethnic distinction or ethno-religious distinction. Basically, every citizen of Russia and everyone who identifies with Russia of whatever, you know, ethnic, racial, religious origins comes under that umbrella. And that's a concept with, you know, deep, deep roots in Russian history, going back even actually centuries before Peter the Great, because Russia as a great Eurasian land empire has an old history of bringing on board and promoting to the topmost positions, you know, people of non-Russian backgrounds, Germans, Tatars, Caucasians, you know, a whole set of different people. And until recently, that was also very much Putin's vision, and he wrote about this explicitly. And it's reflected, by the way, you know, in senior members of his regime, who very often come from non-Russian backgrounds. But Rusky means ethnic Russian. It has strong connotations of also of an Orthodox heritage. And, you know, when you talk about Rusky Mir as opposed to Rasisky Mir, you are talking about a much narrower definition of what it is to be Russian. And, of course, that also has, well, as we see in Ukraine, I mean, it has definite implications for trying to bring ethnic Russians outside Russia, not just into, you know, a Russian sphere, but under the control of the Russian state. But I mean, for me, the really worrying aspect of this is where it could lead Russian internal politics and cultural policies, because leaving aside, of course, the disaster and tragedy of Chechnya, actually both under Yeltsin and under Putin, they handled relations with the Russian ethnic minorities and autonomous republics actually pretty well, and with, you know, considerable tolerance and cultural openness. And Putin himself previously wrote that, you know, going for a narrow ethnic nationalist and ethnic chauvinist of a definition of what it is to be Russian would be a disaster that would threaten the very existence of the Russian state. I do pray that he's not in the process of changing his mind, and that this won't in future define Russian state policy and public attitudes. I'm very much afraid, however, that it may.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, looking at the battlefield in Moscow and Brussels faced off, preparing for winter. We head to another preparation for winter. Brussels is also the headquarters of the European Union. And the European Union doesn't describe all of Europe. We'll include the UK in this as well. And what is to be done about energy resources in the irony of following COP26 at Glasgow just last November? I'm John Batchelor.